G'day, humans. Welcome to the safe space for dangerous ideas. Here's a dangerous question for you. Has our culture ever actually reckoned intelligently, had a grown-up conversation about the newer taboos, especially around race and gender and transgenderism? Or did the media just sort of flip from the casual bigotry that it had in the 20th century to the censorious hysteria of peak woke in a way that actually empowered the rise of the new right and robbed us of the ability to try to think carefully about issues of importance to cultural and social cohesion? One person who was at the coalface of the Great Awakening and trying to think about this in the way that these ideas were articulated to the public is Jeff Mora, who was a comedy writer on one of the biggest progressive satirical shows in America, Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, from its first season right through until 2020, when he left the show because he felt that it had become somewhat ideologically captured, and perhaps for personal reasons as well. Now Jeff has a wildly popular political satire Substack, a comedy Substack called I Might Be Wrong, and I had planned to chat with Jeff because I've been a little bit out of the news loop. I wanted his thoughts on Minneapolis and Epstein and ICE and the 2020 election, ballots in Georgia being seized and Don Lemon's arrest and the Melania documentary, of course, the most important news. But we ended up talking about a much more fascinating subject, which is the one that I just articulated. Like, we sort of address blackface and transgenderism as two examples of maybe where the media lost its way, where we lost the ability to cover the news and to satirize the news without pandering to our audiences and preaching to the choir. I hope you enjoy as much as I did. The one, the only, Jeff Mora. Jeff, lovely to see you again. So we did this debate, this a debate about whether or not, I mean, how did they frame the question again, Jeff? It was this sort of vegan question of like whether we should give consideration to the shrimp of the world, because the argument is there are just so many damn shrimp that are being tortured because humans consume so many more shrimp than they do any other animal that they eat, that we should think about like introducing, like spending a little bit of money to like stun them before we kill them or something. And then you were saying that's batshit crazy to spend that money on people, not squiggly little bottom dwelling.
Shrimp.
Poo eaters.
When we say shrimp, people might be wondering, is there something American Australian lost in translation? Does, you know, shrimp mean something different? No, it's we're talking about the crustacean.
Yes.
And it's from,
although we do call them prawns, you know that.
We call them prawns also. Do you
only
always call them
being,
prawns?
We always call them prawns, yes.
Oh, okay. For us, a prawn is like the bigger one.
Yes. No, in Australia, you might hear shrimp if it's those tiny, tiny frozen things that you would get in a Chinese fried rice takeout something. They might be marketed as shrimp. But anything that's an actual crustacean is a prawn, which was especially egregious because back in the 1980s, you're probably too young to remember this, as am I, but it's legend in Australia.
Flattered you think that. No, I was alive in the 80s. Yeah.
You may not remember the ad that Crocodile Dundee, Paul Hogan, did for Australia, for the Australian tourism, which went wild in America after Crocodile Dundee. He was standing in Australia in the sunshine with some prawns on a barbecue, and he said, come on down under, we'll throw another shrimp on the barbie
shrimp
for
on
you
the barbie.
So now a shrimp on the barbie is like this thing that Americans think that Australians say, and it's something that no Australian would ever say because you would call it a prawn.
Oh, it's funny.
So there you go.
It's funny. It's like if you had an American in an ad in Britain and they're talking about lorries and lifts and stuff, right?
Exactly. That's right. The foreigners are going to have to understand it.
I had no idea. Because it's true. If you asked an American, like, name three things an Australian says, shrimp on the barbie is going to be one of the three.
That's right. And it's from that.
And we might not come up with two others.
Like Foster's. People think Australians drink Foster's, the beer.
And the third one is going to be also Crocodile Dundee. You call that a knife? This is a knife.
That's true.
That's the third one.
That is something we always say.
And I apologize for that accent.
Crocodile. Yeah, it's more knife. Yeah, you got to go through the nose more a bit. But I appreciate the reference to the greatest film Australia has ever made. But Foster's also, interesting story about Foster's, Jeff. Nobody in Australia drinks Foster's. It's not even available.
Oh, is that right?
Really? If you went to a gigantic liquor store, like with aisles and aisles of liquor, they would probably have Foster's somewhere way up the back and they'd have to go and hunt for it. But Foster's did a great marketing campaign of realizing that Australia was popular in America and just marketing themselves as it's Australian for beer. Same as like there are a bunch of wines and things. It's all generally I find that when a brand or a person is doing a whole lot of hoo-ha about how authentically they belong to a particular place, they're usually just shilling bullshit.
It's bullshit. It's a marketing team in New York. Yeah,
exactly.
Every barbecue restaurant in the States, like it was six guys in L.A. and they realize, yeah.
Oh well,
Billy,
what's the
Billy Joe's down home barbecue pit will sell well.
What's the Australian one that you guys have? Outback Steakhouse.
Oh, Outback Steakhouse. That's
right. No Australians ever been there.
People from Miami or something. Yeah.
Yeah. It was set up by a bunch of Americans who at exactly around this time, the Crocodile Dundee time, were like,
yeah,
they were looking for a theme for a restaurant. They thought, what about an Australian theme? And they invented a whole bunch of things that don't exist in Australia. What's a bloomin' onion? No Australian has ever heard of a bloomin' onion. And Australians go to
it's a sin against nature. But kind of tasty. Do you have the equivalent? Do you have the Bizarro World equivalent in Australia, where there are like American things, but it's like the American themed restaurant in Arrested Development, where it's all cowboy? Like, here's your tray of donuts. Like, you have that?
Yes, sort of. But I think America gets a pass because its cultural hegemony is so profound that we do know what everyone in the world knows sort of what America is like because we see it on television all the time. So it's harder to fake. It's harder to fake badly. But there are still American style diners here, which are done up like a 1950s diner with like the red leather and the, you know, the old frosted shakes, malted shakes and stuff like that. That would be a gimmick. But I'm sure that the sin is more egregious when it comes to like German restaurants or something. Like if you go into a German restaurant in Australia, it'll all be like Oompa Loompa ladies and like Frauleins with huge steins of beer and pork knuckles and things. And someone from like, you know, Frankfurt would walk in and go, this is not the Germany design. No.
Yeah, right on the line between cultural interest and offensive stereotype.
This is the knife's edge between those two. Yeah, exactly. I don't even remember how we started talking about Australia. What were we talking about?
The shrimp debate, which already got us way off track. Yes, the argument from Bentham's Bulldog. I'm blanking on the guy who writes Bentham's Bulldog. It's because I always think of
that.
Yeah, the Bentham's Bulldog guy. It's not Jerry Bentham. That would be a hell of a thing. That's the blog.
He's a very old man.
Yes, he has
now.
This. Right. He's still producing.
Yeah, I know. He's rising on Substack very quickly, Jeremy Bentham. His tone's really hitting it.
I think his name is Matthew. Has a very utilitarian position on charity, which is that, you know, obviously your dollar could go to any number of causes. They were trying to take a super, I hope utilitarian is the right word, approach to it.
Yeah.
Sort of, you know, we've heard the phrase effective altruism, looking at that and trying to quantify, you know, what is, you know, one human life versus like the pain of a billion shrimp or however many shrimp. And they did kind of run this calculation and deduce that in his mind, you can do the most good by helping the shrimp. That's because apparently before, I didn't know any of this before the debate, but before shrimp are farmed, they gouge their eyes out because apparently it helps with fertility.
Well, you don't need to gouge a shrimp. Have you ever seen a shrimp or a prawn, Jeff? Yeah, you see their eyes. You don't gouge them. Aren't they sticking? Aren't they jutting out on a little a twiggly thing?
A little on a on a twiggly thing. That is the
eyes.
That is the scientific term. Yes,
googly thing. I'm nothing.
The biologist. If you're talking about
marine,
they always do this. You know, they're on top of the the things on top. It's like not a horn, but
mock my marine biology, Jeff. But it's almost in my brain. It's like if a human put on one of those novelty eyeglasses that have the springs on them with the eyes. With the eyeballs dangling down, you wouldn't need to gouge it. You would just yank. So I think they yank the eyes off the prawn because it makes them more fertile, makes the females more fertile.
Apparently, and I hear your argument that they're kind of begging for it. So, you know, I hear you. There's that. And apparently the way they're
they
killed, it could be more humane.
They could have had inverted eyes, Jeff.
Yeah.
Also, I want to know how they found that. Who was the first person who found out that if you yank their eyes off, the females become more fertile?
That's a great question. What other trial and error was that sick fuck going through?
Exactly.
how many things did they attempt before they landed on the eyes?
I know. And how would I just respect the patience of tracking the fertility data after you've done the yanking and not the yanking. Like, you're not just a macabre son of a bitch. Yeah. You're actually very diligent. You're a diligent nerd macabre son of a bitch.
A combination of Gregor Mendel and Joseph Mengele. That's who you have to be to find that out.
Wow. That must be the highest brow joke we've ever had on a conversation so far. Not even gonna try to dig into explaining it. So we have you here, Jeff, because I've been on vacation and I haven't been paying as much
and couldn't book anybody better. I respect that. Yeah.
No, my producer.
That's how I get most of my bookings
of booking fabulous people. But I felt like, you know what? I need someone in the States who isn't going to be a downer, who can bring me up to speed on a few of the things that have been going on over the past few months, because the pace of news is just head spinning. And when you come back into it after not having been consuming the news on a regular basis, it's like, wait a second, am I supposed to care about Melania's movie or the Epstein files or Donald Trump supposedly shitting himself or Greenland no longer being invaded or Venezuela? What is happening? And Iran and attack and like what? And Minnesota and ICE. And now Trump is sending the FBI into Georgia to round up election officials and prosecute them for having correctly processed the 2020 election. It's
I'm glad you asked. And the correct answer is the Melania movie. Josh, has taken the nation by storm.
I was hoping you'd say
we're
this.
We're all seeing. I did see it.
What?
Because of my stupid job. It's for this goddamn job. I run a Substack.
Wow.
So for my piece that went up this morning, I went and I paid $15 to see Melania. And Josh,
it was in the movie theater.
In the movie theater. Yes, you can't stream it yet. So I went out in public. I looked at it. People saw me walking into Melania.
Okay. There's a lot
to ask.
That's
just the dedication
here,
I have.
Before we even get
blog.
To the movie, I want to know, where did you see it? Like, what city did you see it in, and who was in the theater?
That's a great question. It doesn't have an answer. So suburban D.C., I live just on the Maryland side of D.C., and it was at the mall out here. So I went out to see it, and I did think I'm going to be the only person in the theater. I was not. There were seven women in front of me, seven older women. They knew each other. They're definitely, I think it's, my mom's in one of these groups. She lives near me here in Maryland. And, you know, so I think like they go out and somebody picked a movie, and I don't know if Cheryl's going to be allowed to pick the movie again, but somebody picked Melania, and they seemed to enjoy it. They seemed to enjoy it. They clapped when it was over.
Okay. And what did you think?
Oh, it's an obvious bribe. I mean, it's
now, when you say bribe, just explain
bribe
to people who are not across the news as much as you why it's a bribe and what they were paid, what the Trumps were paid.
So Amazon, I hope I have the numbers right off the top of my head. If they're not exactly right,
they're close.
It's 40 million. They paid 40 million for the rights and 35 million on marketing, which if you know about marketing for movies, marketing for documentaries, marketing for documentaries is like, we will give you a ride to Kinko's and then you can run off as many flyers as you feel like paying for. And that's the marketing budget. 35 million for a documentary is insane. And by the way, also explains why if you squint just right, you can say Melania is the best weekend debut for a documentary in the last 10 years, if you define documentary really narrowly and things like that. It's like, yeah, but it also got a $35 million push behind it. No other documentary gets that. So yes, Amazon, $75 million all in on this documentary. It looks like they're not going to come within miles of making that back, which normally is something that movie studios care about quite a bit. So it seems far more likely to be just a big, it's a transfer of money. And also it's flattering to make this movie. They're trying to make her, the comparison in the movie, it's like very blatant. They're trying to say like, she's like Jackie O, but better. The Jackie O comparisons are many. And they're like, hey, you know how people, you know, kind of, I don't know how dirty I can do this podcast. You know how people kind of cream their jeans over Jackie O's like sense of style, which I always thought was stupid, but people do that. They're like, well, Melania has even more style. So the movie's just her trying on jackets and hats and stuff. And it's the way I put it this morning on a in notes was it's like watching someone watch paint dry. It's just unbelievably boring. And the only reason it exists is because it's a bribe. So.
And so, but Amazon, and there was some deal, was there a deal that Trump was going to approve, or was that the Skydance thing with CBS? I get so confused, but there was something that Amazon wanted to curry favor with Trump about, and then all of a sudden, looky here, we have a Melania documentary that we really, really want to spend $40 million on and lose a lot of money, but we're going to pay you for it.
Well, any company Amazon's size constantly has business in front of the government. You don't even need to specify which thing. There could be various mergers. There are cloud computing contracts that there's a lot of government contracts. In Trump's first term, Trump, because remember, the other thing is Jeff Bezos, who owns Amazon, also owns the Washington Post. So that's a powerful media outlet.
I think that was the assumption that there was something about because hadn't Trump sued?
Yes. Well, I don't know if he
threatened.
This is one of those Trump efforts that ultimately didn't go very well. Also, I'm going to put everyone on your podcast to sleep if I go deep into this, but it has to do with a special status Amazon has under the U.S. government for the deliveries, which is kind of the oil that keeps the machinery going so they can do these deliveries all the time. Trump threatened to take that away in his first term, and people speculate it's because he doesn't like what the Washington Post is writing about him.
Right. You mean literally the physical deliveries of Amazon packages?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, knowing what we know about Trump, we can deduce that it was surely Trump going, you know, what leverage do I have over this guy who owns this newspaper that's writing all this bad stuff about me? Oh, this obscure exemption that has to do with, you know, our postal delivery laws. I can yank that away. So he threatened to do it. Mm-hmm. That was his first term. And again, Amazon has all sorts of interests, including Blue Origin. That's another Jeff Bezos company. So, you know, they have government contracts, or at least potentially could.
So space. So yes. Yeah. Space, Amazon, mm-hmm. Cloud computing. Yeah. So you give the guy $40 million. And find a cool way of doing it, which is that Melania wants to make everyone spend 100 minutes watching her try on hats.
And they did, and I watched it.
It's here so as well, win. Jeff. If you thought that the rest of the world was spared the indignity of watching this movie, I was checking the movie sessions over the weekend, and it was there. It was like one session.
Was it?
At one screen. I think there were like two screens in a city of 5 million people. But it was there. It's on. Like someone thinks that someone's going to watch it.
That's astounding to me.
Yeah.
Because I was there because I was writing about it. I kind of suspected everyone else I see in the theater is also going to be writing about it. That turned out to not be correct. These seven ladies, you know, at least some of them were fans of the film.
I mean, they're old Republicans.
But I can't imagine why an Australian.
They're old ladies who lunch, right? And they're
Republicans. Yes, I think that's right.
I guess there's probably a few people here who are, Trump supporters who want to see a documentary about the First Lady.
I did tell myself if they made a Michelle Obama documentary, would people go see that? I thought, somebody will go see that. So, you know, it's like, okay.
$40 million worth. Like $40 million is a big budget, is a really big budget for a movie. Like, you know, a movie like, you know, you can think of a big independent, like a Blumhouse horror movie or something like that, which would be like a movie like Weapons or something like that would have a budget of less than $40 million, and it would rake in $100 million within, you know, several weeks.
Yeah, and also if you're usually, and the second place bid was Disney at, I think it was $16 million. It was less than half of what they bid. So I think that's a good indication of $40 million is just not what this costs.
Yeah. And normally, the $16 was already had bribe included.
The $16 is also a bribe. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. The non-bribe version is like $1 million. You know, like we'll make money on this if it costs $1 million bucks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, to be fair, it made a couple million in the first weekend, and I don't know how much it'll ultimately do.
So you'd spend five million. You'd probably spend five.
But it's also, the other thing you would want, though, when you're bidding for the rights is you would want access. And they had no access. There are no interviews with Melania. About a third of the movie. Yeah, it's voiceovers, these crappy voiceovers, such trite dialogue that she's obviously reading because her English is not good, by the way. So the subject of this documentary that is in English only kind of speaks English.
When you mail away for your mail order bride, be sure to check the English beforehand, Donald.
Yes.
Beforehand.
That's right. Conversational does not mean fluent. It's two different categories.
At least talk to her on the phone first. I had assumed, Jeff, that it would be like the Taylor Swift documentaries or something where like she is basically working with a producer and a director to tell her story about what her life has been like and what, and you'd get behind the scenes, you know, interviews with her and like her walking into the Oval Office or, you know, her talking about her relationship with the president. That's what I didn't want to see. But I certainly don't want to see it if it's just her trying on hats.
It's just her trying on hats. They got no access. Like I said, there are no interviews with her. I'm sure she worked with the producer, but she worked with the producer to, you know, make it exactly what she wanted.
to
pick out the hats. She's like, don't show me trying on the red hat. I only want the blue hat because that's the one.
She was very involved in which hats she was going to be putting on.
There's no access. About half the movie is just her in cars going from point A to point B. Because that's clearly like, we can't clear you to go and, you know, go into Mar-a-Lago and go to these other locations. Like it's a security thing. So just get her when she's in the car. Get her when she's in the motorcade.
They're in the White House.
They're in the White House for 2 seconds and they're in like the entryway. It's like not an interesting room in the White House.
Right.
And then about a third of the movie is inauguration footage. So it's footage that you could watch on YouTube right now, just from a slightly different angle.
Right. But without her trying to garble her way through the English language superimposed over the top. So you get that for your $40 million. So now that we've covered the most important story that's been going on over the summer, summer down here, my apologies. I know it's been icy. Has it been intolerably icy and brutal in Washington, D.C., Jeff?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes. We had a big snowstorm and, you know, we're not a part of the country that's super used to that. So, yes, nobody can get anywhere right now.
You're not a part of the country that's super used to that. My sister-in-law and my husband are currently in Dallas and Dallas got a ridiculous dump of snow and ice. You want to talk about a part of the country that's not used to getting a dump of snow and ice? It's Texas.
That's right.
The authorities were just like, okay, everyone just plan to stay inside for 5 days because we're not going to be on top. We're just going to have to wait for it to melt. We don't have, who's got a snowplow in Dallas?
Yeah. I think if you're in Texas and you're getting a foot of snow, it's like, well, let's just wait for the other three signs of the apocalypse. We don't know what else to do.
That's right. Are the frogs
we didn't
coming
plan
from
for
the
this
sky?
At all.
Now, but the other thing that I wanted to talk about before we get to, well, should we just talk about Minnesota and just get it out of the way so we don't have to dwell on it too much? You know, ice and things. I mean, the other form of ice, not the cold but the immigration and customs.
Yeah, we're sort of beset by both forms of ice right now in this country.
Yeah, that's right. Too much of both. Down here, we have neither, thankfully. how tense do you, when you're out at the shopping mall and you're joining your seven old ladies to go and watch the Melania documentary, is there any sense in DC or Maryland that phenomenon is imminent or like how on edge are people, if at all? Because you've also had the National Guard in DC.
We got the National Guard here. Yeah, we did. So we didn't get the ICE deployment. The ICE deployment is kind of, we should say ICE and border security, specific to Minnesota. And you know, I don't know how familiar your Australian listeners are with American geography, but Minneapolis is not close to the southern border. I guess it's kind of a border town. It's kind of near the northern border, but even then, a couple hundred miles.
Does Minnesota border Canada?
Yes. Yeah, it does. And then also across a lake, it borders. Yeah, but right. Canada is not where most of our immigration comes from.
I wouldn't have thought so. No,
kind of
certainly not the illegal kind.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. A lot of SNL cast members, but they all had visas. NBC arranges that. It's an odd deployment, and the deployment is in Minneapolis because Trump doesn't like the governor there, and he was trying to draw attention to a scandal. You know, that's the level we're operating on now. Mm. Trump was pissed off at the governor of Minnesota, so that's why they got the heavy ICE deployment.
Well, it's also a blue state, and they've been very proud about it, and they're proud about, like, you know, being kind of, we're welcoming to everybody. So.
Yeah,
if anyone else is as ignorant as I was, and it's rather embarrassing that I didn't know that Minnesota bordered Canada, but it borders, it's got Lake Superior, right, on the northeast.
Mm-hmm. Most pretentiously named lake, yes.
Yeah, and then Ontario is the majority of the border with Minnesota, and then you got, here's your Canadian geography test. What is the province to the west of Ontario?
I want to say Scotland? No. Is it, damn it, there's an acronym I had to learn in like eighth grade for this. Is it Manitoba?
I would have to know in order to be able to answer correctly. But I'm looking at a map.
Confident that I would know. Ding, ding, all right, ding, there ding. We go. There we go.
It's Manitoba. It is not Saskatchewan, which I would have said,
I felt good about that answer because I didn't know if it was Manitoba, but I knew it was in the ballpark, right? I knew it wasn't British Columbia. So.
Very good. So there's a little
for
bit
an
of
American grading on a curve here for an American. Good. That's pretty good.
So Manitoba also borders Minnesota, and I thought Minnesota sat underneath the Dakotas, but that would be Nebraska.
Correct. Yeah. Well, we're learning a lot here about.
We're learning a lot. It's cold there. So they got both kinds of ice. So
cold. Yes, and they got the ICE deployment in DC. We did get the National Guard. Sort of a similar deal. It's kind of, you know, Trump, you know, DC does have a crime problem. It's always hard to talk about these things with precision because on the one hand, like, I don't want to, for those of your listeners who, you know, haven't read my blog, and I assume that's most of them, I am on the left. I am a guy who ends up voting Democrat. I really try not to be one of these people who's going to, like, relentlessly carry water for left-wing or progressive talking points. So when you're talking about crime, and I as a DC, well, now near, I was a DC resident for a long time. Now I live just on the other side of the border. DC has a crime problem. It's like, it's not great. You know, what's the ideal number of murders in a city? Zero. DC's not at that number or particularly close to it.
I think it's it's probably about 9 good ones. You know, there's probably about 9 that I would look the other way on if they happened.
Yeah, but how do you get the right 9 people? That's the tricky thing.
Yeah,
if you
even
got to 9, it'd be the
I'm
wrong.
I'm trying
9.
To develop a new political system that permits a certain amount of government state terror in killing innocents who aren't quite innocent.
Well, we're not there yet. But point taken. Maybe the ideal number isn't 0, but it's.
Less than it currently is in Washington, D.C.
Exactly. Sometimes Democrats will just try to minimize crime and pretend like it doesn't exist. Like, it is a problem, and we could do better. But then the other side of the coin is Republicans, of course, will make a meal of it and be like, you can't walk outside your house without getting murdered. And, of course, there's a racial angle to it, you know, getting murdered by a non-white. And, of course, that's not true either. That's why we ended up with National Guard, because Trump was sort of like, I'll make D.C. safe. I have mostly seen National Guard units wandering around looking very bored. Mm-hmm. Like it's a weird dynamic because the president has this, mission that he's on to make DC safe. And certainly, you know, if you're someone like me, I could point to things I'd like to see the DC government do to make the city safer. Trump sends the National Guard, but it's weird because they're not police men and women. They're army troops. So he's on this mission, but then you actually see the people hanging around the metro station. Like you see them, they're standing there in the metro station. And in my experience, they're typically looking kind of bored. They're kind of like,
well,
what are we supposed to do?
Where's the war? I'm in the National Guard to fight.
Yes. And often they're walking around on the National Mall where, you know, the Lincoln Memorial and the Washington Monument are. Like, that's not the high crime areas. They're just just kind of tooling around like everyone else. They're just sort of, you know, eating a popsicle and just
the cynical and sort of dystopian explanation for why they would be walking around the mall is because Trump likes likes acclimatizing, or as Americans say, acclimating the population to the iconography of militarism. And so if in the future there are disputes about ballots and things, if, you know, in the future there are protests that he wants to quash, it's helpful. I mean, the very cynical version is like he's trying to get us used to the image of troops on the streets so that when he actually deploys them, it's less jarring. The less cynical and more sympathetic, but still pretty awful explanation is he likes the iconography of military power, and he thinks it's cool to be the kind of president who presides over military parades and has men with machine guns wandering around making America great. Yeah. Either way, it's a better explanation for why there's National Guard on the mall than that on the mall they're going to somehow prevent carjackings in the suburbs.
Yeah, with Trump, there's probably something to all those explanations with Trump. I usually think the dumbest explanation is usually the correct one. There certainly is a concern, especially as we get to the midterm elections this November, that he might try. Everyone says we're worried he's going to try to do something. Nobody can quite define what that something might be. But yes, it might be something in the area of some sort of martial law, some sort of curfew, or even just sort of intimidating people so they don't go to the polls. Like, it's all speculation until it happens. But a good dumb explanation is, as you said, he likes the trappings of being the president who can order the military around. He has this habit of telling these stories where he says, somebody came up to me, they said, sir, they're always calling him sir in these stories. It's always a four-star general coming up and calling him sir. He likes that he's got authority over that four-star general. So he likes that. And he's also always trying to win the news cycle. Just he likes how that's going to look on Fox News. You know, D.C. is a crime hellhole, which is, of course, a narrative they love on Fox News. You know, it's a crime hellhole, but I'm going to take charge and solve it by deploying these troops. So he certainly likes that aspect of it, I would think.
Why does he keep saying that people are calling him sir when it sounds so much better to say what they probably are calling him, which is Mr. President? I wasn't going to say anything rude there, but I mean, like, don't you get called Mr. President when you're the president? If I was relating a story and I was the president, yeah. I'd be like, this very important person came up to me and said, Mr. President, you did the best job. That sounds better than saying this very important person came up to me and said, sir, you did the best job. I mean, I get called sir when I'm at a restaurant.
Yeah. Yeah, sure, you at know? McDonald's, they'll say, but sir, nobody, sir, did you have
nobody
the Coke?
Calls,
yeah.
And they never say, Mr. President, would you like fries with that, to me.
Well, you're right. That would be more impressive. But I don't know if you know this about Trump. He ain't smart. So, yeah.
Well,
he probably should do that.
I'll tell you what, he's savvy. If you're just joining us on the live stream and you're not listening after the fact, we're talking to Jeff Mora, who is a satirist and comedy writer. He has a great Substack called I Might Be Wrong, which is subtitled Comedy, Politics, and Swearing in pretty much equal amounts. He is a former writer of Last Week Tonight with John Oliver for the first six seasons of that show. And we'll talk about that in just a moment as well. If you're coming over from Jeff's side, I'm Josh Sepps. And if you don't follow Uncomfortable Conversations, we just find interesting people, often celebrities, often newsmakers, often analysts, to have conversations that are not uncomfortable, but they are about uncomfortable things that would make your asshole pucker up a little bit if someone expressed a strident opinion about them at a cocktail party or a work event. So be sure to subscribe and follow and all that jazz. So, Jeff, I am interested in whether or not you think that there's a role for satire in pushing back against the current moment. Like, I feel a bit paralyzed as a commentator and analyst about what the best strategy of opposition is when you see stuff like the ICE outrages in Minneapolis and now more recently the seizure of ballots in Georgia to try to create prosecutions of election officials for doing their jobs in 2020, or the arrest of Don Lemon for having attended a protest. These sort of really new level, I would say, attacks on civil liberties and things that rhyme with authoritarianism, if they are not it all out. Mm-hmm. I'm skeptical of the utility in general of just doing what the tyrant wants you to do, which is throw yourself in front of his jackbooted thugs and try to get shot or beaten up in order to create a scene. Because I kind of feel like that just plays into the worldview and the narrative of the tyrant anyway. Like, every tyrant knows how to deal with unruly, violent protesters. That's the easiest thing in the book. Like, that's great. That's actually a gift, really.
Yeah.
So the alternatives are laugh at them and mock them, which is harder for them to defeat, especially for Trump, because he hates that. Like, be a court jester that tells truths to the king while everyone watches on. Another is to try to analyze and think about the big picture role that we can all play in sort of, which is sort of more my job, I think, of like trying to understand why people who support him would support him, how we can sort of bridge the divide to avoid collapsing into a total civil war of rival echo chambers where all of us are so certain of our own righteousness that we end up killing each other. But where do you, like, what do you see the path to groping out of this as being?
That's a great question. There's a lot there. I try to not get too grandiose in my thinking about what I'm doing. You know, I've been a comedy writer for a long time. So I was a speechwriter for a long time. I was a speechwriter, and I was doing stand-up comedy at night, and that eventually turned into the job at the John Oliver show. And then I left John Oliver, and now I write my own political comedy blog. So I've had a lot of time to think about what this is and what it isn't. And one lesson I've learned is, like, don't get up your own ass. Because when you're asking, like, is there a role for satire? There are people who will think, yes, I am the dam holding back the flood. I am the antidote to Trump. And it is only I who can slay him. And that, in my experience, is going to lead to some really unfunny and boring stuff. I just try to, I mean, I'm a political guy because, again, that was my job before comedy was my full-time job. And also, it's like, when I studied in school, I'm just, you know, this is the area that I'm in. I've painted myself into this corner for better or for worse.
What was the speech writing? Who were you writing for?
I was writing for the Environmental Protection Agency, which still exists, even though it's a very different agency now. Luckily, I got out, you know, in the 2010s. So,
right. And does that mean for the director of the agency or something to give speeches, updates about what the agency is up to? Like, what?
Yes, I was writing for, at the time, I was writing for one of her assistants, but yes. Yeah.
Yeah, right. Okay. That's so anyway, interesting.
It's what I see myself as doing. I'm talking about what's going on because that's what people want from me. And I try to talk about it in a funny way. So that's where humor comes in. That's what differentiates me from, you know, a column you might read somewhere, is I'm at least attempting jokes. You talked about being strategic in your thinking and the utility, for example, of protests and when might they be useful, when might they not be useful. My column going out tomorrow, I have no idea what tomorrow is in relation to how many people are listening to this, especially because you're in Australia, so you're like a month ahead of me.
It's already tomorrow in Australia.
Yeah, exactly. So for you, last week, my column going up tomorrow from here is about Billie Eilish. Did you hear her at the Grammy Awards?
Well, I mean, I've already read your column because it already dropped here because I'm in the future.
Yeah.
But no, I didn't.
Did it go over well?
Everyone loved it. I got to tell you.
Awesome. Yeah, thanks.
I didn't see this Billie Eilish story.
She won a Grammy, and during her speech, she said, no one is illegal on stolen land. And that got a big round of applause. And I'm writing about how that is exactly the type of celebrity activism that I think is counterproductive. I mean, Democrats are constantly accused of being the open borders party. And there's somebody saying, yes, open borders, hooray, ONPS, our country sucks. And then it got a round of applause.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's also even if it weren't strategically stupid because it's so off-putting to so many Americans and hands the right a cartoon caricature of what they think the left is. It's also just fatuous virtue signaling bullshit.
Yes. Like, there you go. Well
you
put.
Know, it's like, who the fuck are you? What the fuck are you talking about? No one is. Of course, there are people who are here illegally. They are here illegally. Like, cut the bullshit. Now, how do we treat them?
Yeah.
With respect, you know, we have to, we don't want to be shooting people in order to get them out of the country, but there are people here illegally. And when America was founded, lots of colonial empires were invading and colonizing lots of places. That was the absolutely normal thing to do, that everybody was doing all over the place. There was almost nowhere where that wasn't happening. So what the fuck are you talking about?
What the fuck is she talking about?
But very talented, I must say.
Yeah, she's kind of hot. Good singer, probably. I've never heard any of her music, but she's probably talented or something. She won a Grammy. It's a idiotic statement just by itself, because the two parts of it are contradictory. No one's illegal on stolen land. Okay, so the first part asserts, you know, no ability of a people to decide who lives there and who doesn't. But then the second gives a group, you know, an absolute right to the land. So if you have no right to say who's in your society and who's not, then how could land ever be stolen? So it doesn't even make any sense.
If no one is illegal, then all of the non-Native Americans are also not illegal.
We're legal, I guess.
The colonization of America was fine.
My humble opinion is that the way that all went down was bad, and people actually do have some. We could discuss. It's obviously a very long history of how that happened, but people actually do have a right to decide who lives in their society and who doesn't. And as you pointed out, you know, with illegal immigration in this country, it's tough because it is illegal. I always think if I were in their shoes, I probably also would have immigrated illegally.
I'm
not mad about it, but it is illegal.
So have I committed a bunch of crimes. I mean, is there a person listening to this who hasn't committed, who has never sped in a car, who has never jaywalked, who has never, you know, accidentally made a mistake on a form that would mean that they had technically perjured themselves or something? Like, I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I mean, just because you
would still enforce those things.
If
we didn't enforce speeding, we'd get a lot more of it. And it's frustrating the extent to which we struggle to have intelligent conversations on these things sometimes. Because you're right. What did you call it? Fatuous virtue signaling? Yeah, we get a lot of that.
I think I called it fatuous virtue signaling bullshit. But yes, you can omit the bullshit if you want to for the gentle ears of your audience. Our robust Australian ears are slightly more forgiving.
You're all rough and tumble down there. You're very rugged, very rugged people.
I wrestled a saltwater crocodile to death before I even came in here this morning, Jeff.
I assumed you did. Yeah. Just because you had to eat lunch, right? So how are you going to eat lunch if you don't kill a croc with your bare hands?
And I didn't want to kill the kangaroo whose back I had ridden here on, because I need him to ride home on. So I had to go into the local swamp and find myself a crocodile. But in terms of just satire, I'm also interested in the process of analyzing the news and trying to wring jokes from it, especially on TV. So you go to John Oliver's show in 2014. This is Obama time, right? I'm not misremembering
nobody
my
called
history
it that,
there.
But yeah, he was the president. Yes, that's right. Nobody said, it's Obama time.
That's what I called it every morning. I got out of bed and I was like, it's Obama time for eight years. I did that.
Also, with your accent, I have to say, I had to figure out from context clues that you're referring to Barack Obama. There are a lot more A's in his name when it's said with that particular
Obama.
Accent.
How do you say it?
Yeah, so... Obama. We really lean into the O,
Obama. And the Brits, you know, the Brits, they drove me, it shat me to tears. They would always say Obama.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they, you know.
President Obama. I'm like, have you ever heard the man say his name? I challenged one of them once to say, why don't you say his name properly? She was like, in English, in the construction of consonant, vowel, consonant, vowel, the second vowel is short. And I was like, what the fuck? This is fatuous virtue signaling bullshit again. The man has a name and he says the name that way. Billie Eilish.
That's right.
Stop giving me this bullshit. What are you talking about?
That actually is such a British attitude, because it is a Kenyan name, but they're like, no, but here's how we would say it. And therefore that is correct.
Yes, here's how we would say it if he was British, which he's not. So
imagine he was
like
from Kent, for example. Yeah, that's
right.
How they approach it.
So anyway, for 8 years, I was getting up and yelling, it's Obama time, into my mirror. I was in blackface while I was doing it, Jeff, and I would take it off before leaving the house, because I know that that's not appropriate.
Okay in Australia since like the 80s, right?
Oh, my goodness. You have no idea. I just showed my husband for the very first time a few weeks ago a video of something that happened in Australia in 2009.
Is this the Harry Connick Jr. clip?
Yes. Have you seen
I've seen this. Yes, I've seen this. Yeah.
So in 2009, they brought back an old iconic television show that in Australia was, think like the Ed Sullivan Show, like back in the day, right? Yeah. It was called Hey, Hey, It's Saturday. And it was on every Saturday night. It was like a family variety show. Mm-hmm. I think it was live back in the day. And they thought, let's resurrect the show. And as part of, and I think it ran for a few years, but it was never as iconic as it was back in the, you know, 70s and 80s or whatever. And as part of it, they thought, let's bring, they had one of the segments on the show was a talent quest show where these, you know, it would almost be like Letterman's Stupid Human Tricks or something. It wasn't mm-hmm. a real talent show. It was like people who, total amateurs doing terrible, terrible amateur acts. And they would have celebrities
more
on a panel.
More goofy than like real talent.
Yeah, more
talent,
goofy. Yeah. It was like a gong show, if you know, like the old tradition of you bang a gong and, you know, the idiot stops doing what they're doing. And they literally had a gong, I think. And so they thought, well, instead of getting new acts, why don't we get some of the classic acts that everybody loved back in the 70s? And they'll come back and they'll do their act again. And one of those
What could go wrong?
Three white guys in blackface doing a like a vaudeville, almost Jim Crow, like Al Jolson-y.
Weren't they dancing to a Michael Jackson song
or
something?
Oh, that's right. They were dancing to
I think they were, but yes, they were in blackface and wigs and yeah.
And one of the celebrities on the panel who's judging is Harry Connick Jr., who's been on the show a bunch of times. He's very popular in Australia. He's more popular in Australia than he is in the States for some reason.
Is he?
Yeah.
Okay.
He was big down here. He always sold out his concerts. He was on Australian television quite a lot. He did spent a lot of time down here. So beloved American institution in Australia. And he's just sitting there. And he's like, I don't even know what to say.
Oh, God.
And then during the ad break, he went up to the host of the show, who's like a very Ed Sullivan-y, like iconic figure, and was like, I can't continue to be part of the show unless I say something after the ad break. And so they came back from the ad break, and there was this very earnest, embarrassing moment where it's just Harry Connick Jr. and the Australian host, whose name escapes me, and the host is like sort of awkwardly saying like, well, obviously it wasn't our intention to offend you in any way, Harry, but, you know, you're a great friend of the show. And so I wanted to give you this opportunity to express yourself. And he does a masterful job, I thought, Harry Connick Jr. of being
it really raised my opinion of Harry Connick Jr. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He basically just says like, in my country, that is completely offensive and, you know, is reminiscent of a really hurtful history and would be seen as undoing enormous advances that we feel like we've made in recent decades in race relations. And if I'd known that anything like that was going to be on this show, to be honest, I would have asked for more money.
Yeah.
I would have asked for $40 million and a Melania deal. So when you say black, like it is amazing. And my husband, who's American, was like, how the fuck did that go on the air in 2009? Yeah. And it's like, Australia is definitely had different norms. I think social media and the Great Awakening changed things. So now we're probably on similar pages. But up until the 2010s, that was still possible.
Well, you see a lot more of what's going on here now. So, an Australian, obviously, well, probably until pretty recently, wouldn't know the whole history that we had with blackface. I do this segment on my podcast, called News from 100 Years Ago. I'm reading the New York Times from 100 years ago because you can get those. And I am learning a lot about the 1920s. I'm becoming an accidental expert on the 1920s. And I'm learning a lot about the trends and what they found interesting. They find air travel very interesting. There's a lot of optimism about the League of Nations. And another thing is, obviously, the race stuff is just a different world. It's really backwards. And then I open every episode with a copyright expired song, which is 100 years old. This is how I got into doing the news from 100 years ago, because I was starting with these songs that are 100 years old. And minstrelry was gigantic in the United States. It was a whole genre, and you can't watch 10 seconds of these clips today without just wanting to, you know, curl into a ball. I guess, especially if you're white. It's cringeworthy no matter what race you are. But if you're white, you also know, oh, God, because it's ugly, ugly stuff. But we also, you know, like we're aware of that and kind of went through the process of understanding why that's wrong.
Exactly. I mean, and the guy's name, the host's name is Daryl Summers. People in the chat are telling me this is one of the benefits of doing it live.
Okay.
I think you're right that like there was no intentional racism there. It's a bit more like the Justin Trudeau, you know, in blackface, like at a time when it wouldn't have been obvious to those people who put on that segment that, and to be honest, I'm still not sure that it actually makes a lot of sense morally to have an injunction that is as absolute as it has become, either on that or on, for example, the N-word. I've always thought that the phrase the N-word is fatuous virtue signaling bullshit, since we've now coined that phrase, that there are contexts in which it should be okay for us to talk about how terrible the word is, in which we're not, you know, in which we're smart enough to understand when it's being used as a slur and when it's being used, when it's being mentioned. And similarly with blackface, you know, if you're mocking, degrading, demeaning people on the basis of their race, that's one thing. I would have thought that it would be possible to live in a world in which, I mean, I think if the world were less racist, let me put it this way. A world in which it were possible for a white person to put, you know, to darken their face for the purposes of a role or to talk about the existence of racial slurs without treading on eggshells would be a less racist world than a world in which those have to be taboos.
Yeah. If you start from, and by the way, we're now having a conversation that kind of like it didn't happen in America, because you're right, that we had blackface. And if you watch those minstrelsy clips from back in the day, there's no doubt about what blackface was and why it was wrong.
Yeah.
And now we have these taboos, which you're saying you're getting in Australia because you see our social media. So now we have these taboos about blackface that have popped up. But defining what blackface is, people often don't do. We really skipped that part. So that's a conversation that we didn't have. This podcast is called Uncomfortable Conversations. So what the hell? Let's get into it. I've talked about this with actual black people. Like Thomas Chatterton Williams and I used to do a podcast. So I've talked about it with him.
Seriously?
Yeah, very briefly.
Thomas is one of my favorite writers, and I consider him a friend, even though we don't hang out as much as I
He's a great dude. Yeah,
but he's been on this show. He's a really good. I've read all of his books. I think he's brilliant.
He's a good dude, and always up for an uncomfortable conversation. Yeah. We had these taboos that popped up, and we haven't always had conversations about why the rules are what they are, or even what the rules are. They're unclear a lot of time. And we can surely agree, like, the table stakes for this conversation is like, okay, number one, racism's bad, duh. And number two, you don't want to do things that stereotype or caricature a group of people or a race. You know, how offensive would it be if, you know, I wouldn't even want to see if somebody decided I'm going to do a caricature of a white person. It's like, I don't want to see what that is. But then you had cases like Jimmy Fallon did an impression of Chris Rock on Saturday Night Live in the 90s, the late 90s. And as they always do on Saturday Night Live, they made him look like Chris Rock, and that involved paint. But he wasn't doing an impression of just any generic black guy. He was doing an impression of Chris Rock specifically, and the makeup that they put him in, you know, and again, they always do this on SNL. If you're playing the president, you know, they're going to make you look like the president. It was, you know, they made him look like Chris Rock. It wasn't some cartoonish generic black guy. But then in the Great Awakening, you know, 2020 specifically, he had to apologize for that. There wasn't really a conversation about like, is that blackface or is that different? Because minstrelsy, like, it's blackface and it's, you know, a caricature of an entire racial group. But wasn't that an impression of Chris Rock? We never had this conversation.
No. Well, I mean, Megyn Kelly tried to have that conversation on the Today Show and was fired.
Yeah.
Having that conversation.
Okay. I was working in TV when that happened. I will say that show was hanging by a thread, and then that happened.
True. That's true. I mean, that's true of Colbert as well. I mean, that's true. There's yeah. always, it's never a unicausal thing, but it certainly didn't, the huge brouhaha about that didn't help. And the straw
that broke the camel's back, if you say that in Australia. Yeah.
We don't say it frequently, but it's understood.
Okay, there you go.
Although,
that was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Here's a tidbit of Australiana for you. You're going to love this, Jeff. You ready? You're sitting down? Are you holding onto your hat?
I don't have one.
Where are the... holding onto Melania's hat, perhaps. Which country has the largest number of wild camels in the world?
Well, you wouldn't be asking me this unless the answer was Australia. So
that's right.
Australia?
Wouldn't it be funny if I was just like, the United Arab
like
Emirates,
Saudi
across,
Arabia, just like you, just like you thought.
Exactly. Yeah, Australia. Australia also has the best...
How? Australia, how do you have wild camels? Did two get brought in 1820? Yes. Two camels stole a loaf of bread in England, and they got shipped to the wild, and then just went fuck nuts on each other, and now you're neck deep in camels?
You cannot trust a British camel. That's what my grandpappy always used to say. They're wily, and they were getting shipped out here in the convict ships. No, they brought out camels. I don't know who it was in the early days of the settlement. Invasion. Who brought out camels? But I think they, as you can imagine, they're extremely useful for traveling long distances when you don't have an air-conditioned Lexus to cross large desert areas.
Which were hard to get in the 19th century. Yeah.
They were very hard to get.
They were very expensive, yeah.
So I don't know if you know about Australia's geography, but Australia is the same size as the contiguous United States. It's like, I think a lot of Americans think Australia is like Texas. It's the same size as
I knew
United
you were about as big as us, yeah.
And it has half the population of California, a bit more. It has basically the population of Florida, which is all clustered basically around a band. if you think of from Key West up to what would it be? Probably you wouldn't even get to. Well, no, you'd get past Florida in terms of the geography of it, but you wouldn't even get past Atlanta, say, and 100 kilometers inland, and that's the entire population, and the whole rest is desert or rainforest.
Okay,
so the camels were handy, and so they brought them out, and the reason why Australia has the best genetically pure, most sought-after camels that the Arabians lust after in their loins is because they've been breeding them all. And so in the Middle East, they're all, kind of fucked up the same way that dogs are all sort of fucked up when they're purebreds. and here we've had like 200 years of evolution of these camels who've just been out there wandering around the outback because nobody's used them in over 100 years. We don't do anything with them. And they breed like rabbits or camels. And so there you go. That's your Australia camel trivia for the day.
I came on this podcast hoping to learn nothing about Australia. That was honestly one of my goals. As an American, it harms my America-centric view of the world. Mm. And remember, I'm not only an American, I'm a liberal East Coast elitist, so I really don't want to know about anything outside of the D.C. New York corridor,
The Acela corridor.
The Acela corridor, exactly.
I lived in New York for some time, Jeff.
Though I am glad if we're going to get into a discussion of racial purity, which is another thing I don't like to do on a podcast, I'm glad it was about camels because that is the topic on which let's talk about how racially pure the camels are.
The other conversation about racial purity, or rather the one that we didn't quite finish there, because I do want to lean into the uncomfortable conversation bit because I think it is useful.
Okay.
So your point is that we basically went from total sort of carelessness about a really harmful form of old entertainment, which was
demeaning and degrading. Not just carelessness, I wouldn't even say, like joy in the characterization.
Right.
It was an enormously popular, hilarious. People loved it. They could not get enough minstrelry. It was an enormously popular form of entertainment.
Sorry, I was talking specifically about, say, the transition from between 2005 and 2015 or something, or 2005 and 2020, right? Where there was not a great, no one was calling out for blackface in when it went on Australian television in 2009.
Correct.
But
it was.
You know what I mean? It was just like no one really thought about how the complicated nature of it in the mainstream.
Yeah, I was born in 1980. Minstrelry in the U.S. long gone by 1980.
I mean,
even
so.
Even like sort of like post World War II, minstrelry not really a thing, but enormously popular in like vaudeville 1920s. Yeah,
I'd like to believe there was one guy in Mississippi who was keeping it alive in his shed. You know, he was like, "Dagnabbit, I'll be 6 feet in the cold ground before minstrelry dies in these United Confederate States."
He just loves the form. He just loves the form. And maybe even would concede, like, "Yeah, it's racist, but I love the form."
Exactly. You can say so much. You can say so much about the human condition.
There was someone who was the last guy, someone who showed up at an audition like, ha, and they went, no, Monday, we decided we're not anymore. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God, that's so true. There was the last, this is a show, Jeff, write the screenplay for a movie, the last minstrel show. It's the, there must have been the last minstrel show in America. What's that story? Who are these guys clinging on?
Yeah.
That's great.
Even by the standards of stuff I write, that's not going to get made by a network, which is saying something.
That's like, you could almost make a version of The Producers where the show that they pitch is a show called The Last Minstrel Show.
Yeah.
It would be that toxic. It's like the springtime for Hitler would be there'd be a big minstrel show in the middle of it. That would be the show within a show.
Yeah.
Great. Well, lots of laughs.
Okay. Actually, you're getting to another interesting part of this conversation. So, you know, I described, is it blackface every single time any makeup is used? Is that the standard, just the existence of makeup? If so, why is the makeup the thing? And, but another good question is, so another thing we lost is we lost a couple episodes of 30 Rock. Do you know the show 30 Rock? It's one of my favorite shows.
One of my favorite shows of all time. Oh, yeah.
I kind of assumed it, you know, you seem to be a man of good taste. I assumed you love 30 Rock. It's a hilarious show. On the live episodes, they did two live episodes of 30 Rock. And one of the running jokes in that show is they would cut to old episodes of old shows from years past because they're kind of, you know, honoring the history of live TV.
One of the
things they cut to was an Amos and Andy type show. You know, I said there wasn't a ton of minstrelry post-World War II. I'm wrong because Amos and Andy was a radio show that then became, I think it briefly became a TV show. And it was two white guys. And one of them, at least one of them, it's like, you know, I've never seen this thing, was doing a, you know, generic black guy voice, a minstrelry voice. So the joke on 30 Rock was they cut to one of those shows. And the joke is, of course, about how wildly inappropriate it is.
Yes.
It's like, holy shit, can you believe
we
used to have that? So the joke, and it has John Hamm in blackface.
Right.
And, of course, Tracy Jordan, who plays Tracy Morgan on 30 Rock, playing an old-timey character. You know, John Hamm walks in blackface. He goes, you know, he freaks out. He goes, oh, hell no. You know, and the joke is, oh, my God, that's terrible.
Yeah.
Those two episodes of 30 Rock are no longer on Peacock.
Mm.
And my feeling as a comedy writer is the joke there was, this is bad. Mm. Yes, there was blackface, but the comment on the blackface was, this is terrible. Can you believe we used to do that?
Mm.
And that comment, I think, is absolutely unmissable. There's no other interpretation you can have of it. So I again, as a comedy writer, I feel like, don't we want jokes that say, like, you know, blackface is bad? Why did that get the Stalin treatment? I don't think that really makes sense.
It's the same phenomenon as, I don't know if you know the classic British sitcom Fawlty Towers.
Of course.
You know, outing after Monty Python. And two of those episodes aren't available, or I don't know if they've been reinstated, but they were pulled in 2020 or 2021 because there's a Nazi. I think it's a German Nazi.
Is it the Don't Mention the War? Is it the Don't Mention the War episode?
I don't know what episode it's from, but basically, the old guy in the restaurant who used to fight the Nazis is racist, and part of the joke is that he's still living in the past, and so he uses slurs and things. And so for that reason, it's exactly the same phenomenon. Similarly, I mean, when I was working on HuffPost Live, I was living in New York from 2012 and to 20 16, and I had an activist. So I don't know if you remember this, but Stephen Colbert, when he was doing the Colbert Report and he was doing the mm-hmm. character of the right wing guy, he did a joke about the Washington Redskins. You remember this?
I remember this whole thing extremely well because it was a big deal in my world because I was writing at John Oliver at that point. So yeah.
Oh, okay. So I initiated that whole thing. It was my it was my interview with the activist who was trying to get Colbert fired on HuffPost Live that went viral.
Oh.
That caused the upset that then Joe Rogan played it. You know, Colbert heard about it. Colbert had to come on and talk about it as a result of this interview with this woman who went by the name of Suey Park. And the gag that Colbert had done was he was saying that the reason why the head of the boss of the Washington Redskins was donating money to an indigenous education fund was because he was refusing to change the name of his racist name of his sports team from the Redskins. And Colbert then went on to say, I too have been accused of racial stereotypes in the past, and they played tape of fictitious old instances of him, you know, pretending to be a Chinese person. And then it came back to him in the present day, and he said, in order to rectify this, I'm mm-hmm. setting up a new foundation called the Ching Chong Ding Dong Foundation for Oriental Whatever. Mm-hmm. And this was
the joke
taken.
Being his fix is itself racist.
His fix is racist. The
a joke
stuff
that nobody watching the show
is
missed.
Racist. Nobody missed it. His yeah. target is a person, the head of the Redskins, who Colbert thinks is racist, and is therefore saying his solution to the racist name is inadequate. That's the reason the joke is funny. You mm-hmm. don't get to fix, you know, racism by simply tokenistically creating some yeah. foundation that you don't give a shit about as a way yeah. of trying to buy off your critics.
Yeah.
Like,
how much to get out of this? 80,000? I got that. I'm rich. Okay. 80,000 right, and we're square again. Yeah.
It is an anti-racist joke. Yes. It is a firmly anti-racist joke, but it deploys.
Yes. As was the joke on 30 Rock. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And it was so I did this disastrous interview with the woman who was trying to get some notice for the Cancel Colbert campaign. And mm-hmm. she basically, I would sort of said, do you not understand what satire is? Like what the target of the joke is. And yeah. she was like, well, I understand that as a white man, you feel that it's your right to talk down to women of color, and that's understandable. But
oh, boy.
I'm not going to enact the labor of explaining to you why it's deeply offensive for you to question my opinion. I was like,
oh, man.
What is going, like, and it was one of those early moments of wokeness.
I was going to say, it was so early.
It was so early. It was like, because it was 2012 or 2013, I didn't know what was happening.
It was at least 2014.
Didn't know what was happening. Oh, it might have been 2014. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right, because you were on John Oliver, right. Mm-hmm. And it was like, it was this one of those watershed things that just suddenly, it was like, I'm talking to an avatar of another human being who's treating me as an avatar of a white man. We're not talking to human, we're not human minds having a conversation that's based on reason. I'm a cardboard mm-hmm. cutout of a white man, and she's a cardboard cutout of a woman of color, as far as she's yeah. concerned. And so eventually I just said, I'm not criticizing your idea, but it's a stupid idea. Like the idea that that we should not try to understand the context of a piece of satire, and that we should try to get someone fired for a piece of satire before understanding the piece of satire. And so she was just like, well, I find that totally unhelpful, so I won't participate in this conversation.
And after that were you deported to Australia?
Sadly, it was my last day on the air. Fortunately, it was early enough and HuffPost was liberal enough that worked. But of course, if that conversation had happened 6 years later or 7 years later, I
was
going to have a job for sure.
I was going to say, it's funny you should say that, because it is funny you say HuffPost was liberal. And yet that's the thing. I'm an old school liberal, and free speech and not seeing people as their race is like core liberal things. I mean, the things she tried to pull on you there, the standpoint epistemology, you know, the traditional liberal response to that would be, it doesn't matter what group I'm in or what group you're in. It only matters the strength of our arguments. And it's interesting for me to hear that at that time, that was the Huffington Post's view. I should have said HuffPost Live because we were
a business within a business. And I think the whole ethos was, let's just have the kinds of freewheeling conversations that are, you know, that are uncensored. I would not necessarily say that the entire publication's editorial position was as open-minded, maybe, as the things that we could get away with saying on the air, but it was a great place to work for me.
I underwent the same, you know, I experienced the same things at Oliver, that, you know, the same shift, you know, I would say from liberal values to, you know, whatever it is now. When I got there in 2014, like I said, I think I've stayed pretty consistent over the years. I'm just a liberal. I sometimes say Obama liberal, just to kind of give people idea of like where I'm coming from. And I feel like that was really normal and not weird for that environment back then. But then by the time I left in 2020, I was like the right edge of the political spectrum in that office. So, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, you know, progressive shift. Sometimes you hear the phrase like successor ideology or whatever. But yes, the values changed. It got very different in that 6 years.
Yeah. I mean, I usually just talk about social justice, like identity politics, as opposed to liberalism. Did you leave or were you pushed? What was the nature of your department?
I left. It was don't let the ass hit you in the door on the way out when I left.
Yeah. Wow, it's funny. That's almost identical to me at the public broadcaster here as well, where I had a public radio show on the main broadcast network in the largest market in Australia, and that was from 2021 to 2023, and it was the same situation where it was sort of like, you know, my tenure being made impossible because of the things that I wanted to talk about and the kind of conversations that I wanted to have that were inconsistent with.
Luckily with it didn't get quite that bad with me. You know, it was just John and I kind of falling out of love with each other. We had to get divorced. And it was like we had to do it. And then also it's like, I wanted to do scripted TV. Late night is a grind. It's kind of a young man's game. And I was 40 at that point. So it's like, do I want to be a lifer? So all those kind of more banal considerations were part of it. But so yeah, we're just kind of not on the same page.
Tell me about the golden halcyon days at the start. So when it was Obama time, loop us back to that rather long tangent, which I also didn't close. I didn't close the loop entirely on what I was saying. I just wanted to make that point clear about it was, we were cool with levels of racist blackface. And then suddenly we were so furious about any use of that blackface.
Paint at all. Yeah.
Of any kind of paint that it was a firing offense, or at least it was attempted to be a firing offense to have ever done it in any context for any reason. And I suppose the point of my show is in part to try to go back, to try to find those rifts, those disjoints, and actually dig our fingers into them and go, okay, well, what are the conversations that we should have had that we still should have in order to understand a non-binary view of the world where it's not like A or B, but there is something more reasoned about and nuanced about our approach. That was all I wanted to say to close the chapter on that thing. So 2014, you come into John Oliver's show. You don't yet know that there's going to be an orange clown wrecking everything in two short years. And so what's the process in just in terms of the writer's room, in terms of topics, in terms of how you get... I remember there was a shift in maybe season two, correct me if I'm wrong, you'll be able to tell me, into doing much more newsy stuff. And I think, were there journalists hired to do more of the kind of long-form investigative stuff than there was initially?
Your memory is good, because we did start out thinking, okay, how is this not The Daily Show? Because of course John came from The Daily Show, and so did our executive producer Tim Carvel. He had been head writer at The Daily Show, and in addition, like some of the staff, none of the writers actually, but some of the staff from The Daily Show. So it was very much a Daily Show spinoff, and we were trying to figure out, okay, but what's our value added? What do we do that The Daily Show doesn't? And pretty soon we figured out, okay, we do these more long form pieces because we don't have ads. We're on HBO. It's a proper 30 minutes, not 22, which is what a network TV show is in the US. And there's no interview, and we're once a week, not four times a week, which is what The Daily Show is. So that all pointed to longer form pieces. It's funny that we're having this conversation right now because the podcast Blocked and Reported. Do you know, have you ever heard of Blocked and Reported?
Good friends with Jesse and Katie. Okay. Jesse's been on the show a bunch of times. So is Katie.
Oh, has okay. Yeah. And I'm friends with, I've never met Katie in person. Katie and I have emailed.
No one has met Katie in person because she lives in the woods in the Pacific Northwest and she never sees anybody.
Exactly. She's 80% hermit. But I've emailed with her and she's very nice. And then Jesse and I have done some live shows. So yes, I'm very friendly with Jesse.
Fabulous.
And I'm a fan of their podcast.
Yes.
And they are at this moment, we are speaking in between part one and part two of a dissection of the John Oliver net neutrality piece. And Katie emailed me about this because, you know, she figured I probably knew something. And I do remember that piece very well. It happened in season one. And it was one of the first pieces that made us think, OK, we can do this kind of in the weeds sort of maybe 60 minutes, more analytical, less like what's in the headlines this week and more drill down on an obscure topic. Because we did the net neutrality piece. It was well received. And that made us think, OK, we can do this. Jesse and Katie, mostly Katie at the moment, are kind of getting into errors that were made on that piece. And she's got some good points. Now, my involvement with that piece was minimal. It sounds like I'm trying to, you know, defend myself.
Convenient.
Like, don't talk to me. Yeah, somebody else. But the fact of the matter is, every piece has a long, an A story, as we call it, has two leads. And I was not one of the two leads on that piece. So I remember being in some meetings at the beginning and I came in at the end to add jokes. I didn't really have anything to do with the substance of that piece. So when Katie is running through and saying this thing was wrong, that thing was wrong, this thing was maybe not technically wrong, but misleading, it was kind of interesting to me. I didn't know that. I will say, though, we have writers on the show. I'm not there anymore. The show's still on. I'm not there anymore. We had writers. We had researchers. The researchers are really in charge of the news. You know, you asked, did you hire journalists? Like, yeah, that's what they did. But they make mistakes. They make mistakes. And I got to say, some of them, you know, let me not ascribe motivations, but let me say they got stuff wrong all the time. And it was known they were getting stuff wrong all the time. And I was, you know, remember what I said when I left, it was like, don't let the ass hit you in the door on the way out. I was getting arguments with the researchers all the time because they're just putting lies on the show all the time.
Why do you think?
Well, because this is speculation on my part.
Yeah.
A, they're true believers. B, you'll know this from working at Huffington Post, like your job is to get stuff on the show. Your job is to pitch stuff and get it on the show. So you can get stuff on the show if it's a narrative that really fits what your viewers are going to want, you can get that on the show, even if it's not really true. And there was a lot of massaging of stuff to make it fit the narrative. A very common thing is just omit counter arguments. This one guy was horrendous with statistics. I think he just didn't understand statistics at all. So he didn't understand if you're like cherry picking time frames or being weird with baselines or out of context figures and things like that. So he would do a lot of those underhanded tricks to, you know, make a narrative seem more potent than it was. And that stuff was just endemic. And that particular guy that I'm talking about, he's still there.
It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, my sense, I didn't have experience of it at HuffPost because the wheels fell off HuffPost Live in 2017, which was just early enough that we, before the full brunt, I think, of woke madness. And also we were cloistered in our own, side thing of HuffPost Live, which had its own sort of floor and didn't really report to anybody. But I did notice that at the public broadcaster. And my sense during peak woke in mainstream left-wing, well, center-left, you know, worthy progressive media outlets, of which I would include John Oliver's show as one, was that there was a sense that there's a larger truth that is being told and that needs to be told and honored. And the details of actual facts can sometimes be used as weapons to undermine a worthier truth. And so people who I would have expected more from were able to twist things, shade things, overlook things, not be totally upfront about things. There was also a transgender piece on John Oliver's show, which was the moment at which I fell out of love with that show, which I think was great in its early days.
What year was it? Because there are two pieces and I wrote the first one. And don't worry about offending me if it was the first one.
I have no recollection because I didn't see it at the time. It was after I drifted away from the show for just family reasons and not watching the show anymore that I saw it. And I was like, oh yeah, I don't think I'm going back to it. But what were the two?
the one I wrote was, and when I say I wrote, it's always a team effort. So I was one of the two leads on the piece that aired in 2015. And
wouldn't have been that early.
Okay. Because there was a second one that was done after I left, which was also the subject of a Blocked and Reported episode. So if people want the full rundown on that.
Okay, maybe it was Jesse who brought it to my attention then.
If there was a
Blocked and Reported episode about it, then that's probably where I got it from. Because, no, it was a very woke trans one. It was just not serious about actually grappling with, at the risk of being misunderstood as being like a transphobe or something. I mean, I'm a gay guy. I'm married to a guy. We have heaps of trans friends. I'm like super, super cool with it. Trans people should be respected and have all of the same rights as everybody else. But there was a way of talking about the particular issue, about this issue, which elided any difference between a 15-year-old autistic girl whose friends are all declaring themselves to be genderqueer and the way she might want to be treated by the medical establishment versus what we traditionally called a transsexual person who, from the moment that they were born, insists that they were born into the wrong body and is going to live a life of misery if we don't honor that. It was like there weren't these two things. It was like it's just this thing that is trans, and you have to have fealty and deference towards anything that any activist says about pediatric medicine, about like hormones, about blockers. Like, there is no conversation to be had here. There's no conversation to be had about women's private spaces, about whether or not women who have penises should be in crisis rape shelters. There's like, it's all just bigotry. It's all just right-wing bigotry. Like, that kind of attitude I just found to be so anti-intellectual, but people were able to push it because they felt that there was a larger truth, which is that we live in a traditionally heteronormative, prejudiced, structurally racist society dominated by, certain types of people, and I'm on the side of the downtrodden. Therefore, we shouldn't let facts get in the way of a mission.
Yeah. I'm sure that's it sometimes. I don't know why people do things that way. I mean, we're talking about, being a hack. Why are people hacks? There are probably different reasons. I don't know. I did watch that episode you're talking about, which was like 2023 or thereabouts. So, well after I was gone. And I happen to know which researcher did that piece, and I didn't overlap with her. So I have no comment on her skills. But although I did see the end product, and I know that many of the aspects of that piece have already aged badly, including, I know one thing they did is they put up that graph of left-handedness, which is such a facile argument. Do you remember this part of the piece by any chance?
No, remind me.
Yeah. Well, so it's about how societal acceptance of a phenomenon can change the extent to which that phenomenon is expressed. So, for example, back in the day, if you were left-handed in school, they'd smack you on the left hand with a ruler until you started writing with your right hand. So they have this graph of the people who are self-reported as left-handed, and it, around when they stopped doing that in the earliest part of the 20th century, it goes up and eventually plateaus, and now you have, I think it's like 10% of the population is left-handed. By the way, I question the statistics in that graph itself, but it's ultimately not important. That graph is put up to argue that the rise that we have seen in people identifying as transgender is for the same reason. It's because society is more accepting of transgender people. So there are the transgender people were always there in the numbers we experience now, but they're only now, open about it. Now, I've for a long time thought very clearly two things are going on here. Number one is that Like, yes, absolutely. If you were trans in the 50s, you probably just took that to your grave. You probably never said anything to anybody and you just never knew about it. So I think you'd honestly have to be very daft to imagine that's not happening. So that is one thing that's happening. Societal acceptance, and we're seeing more expression because of that. And the second thing I think that is equally obvious is that there is a, I think social contagion is too strong of a term, but there's
not in all cases.
A trend. Pick your term. Not all people who were identifying as trans in 2023 really were. They're, you know, very often they were young people and they're going through something they didn't fully understand. But it was such a hot topic that, and we know so much about how this stuff was being diagnosed. We know about the shoddy diagnoses, and we all know what it's like to be a teenager if you've been a teenager. That to believe that none of that was happening, I think it's none of it, like 0%.
I mean, it's such a malleable thing, one's identity, and we're such a social species. It would be extraordinary, yes, if there wasn't. Human is an island. Like, of course, we're influenced by. When it comes to the messy diagnoses of who am I and where do I belong and how do I fit in, yeah, and how masculine or feminine am I and how queer or not am I, like these are much more ambiguous ideas than left-handedness. They're even more, yes, ambiguous ideas than sexuality, which is more hardwired. I mean, I also think that sexuality is more fluid than we give it credit for, but even that is more fixed than a notional idea like, do I feel like I have aspects of my personality that are more feminine than masculine, yeah, and am I therefore on a spectrum of non-binariness? Like, of course, how could ideas didn't have the capacity to change human self-identification and thinking and behavior, what would be the purpose of ideas? What would be the purpose of us talking or debating about anything? Like, the whole point is that we think that it's going to have an effect.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they very clearly do. And all you have to do, or at least all I have to do, is remember being a teenager and remember how easily influenced I was about all manner of things and how I didn't know who I was or where I fit. And, you know, thank God I didn't have the internet back then, or at least I had, you know, crappy dial up. Whereas if you wanted to get confused about yourself, it was really going to take a long time. I didn't have any of that. And I think, you know, some of the people who write most passionately about this are people like Andrew Sullivan, you know, gay people. And I think they're imagining what it would have been like had they been subject to that environment at that age. It kind of sounds like, you know, as hard as it was to figure things out, it would have been even harder if I had, you know, Reddit boards in my ear telling me this or that. But the point I'm trying to get to is that already in the last few years, we've seen the number of transgender identifying people going down some. Which does indicate that, yes, there was a societal aspect to this, you know. So already the left-handedness graph, you know, people aren't the numbers of left-handed people aren't going down because there wasn't a social aspect to that. But there was clearly a social aspect to people identifying as trans. And
I mean, another point that has been made, Jeff, that sort of complicates that picture that John Oliver Story was trying to push, is that when being gay was no longer taboo, you know, and this was probably this was a very rapid civil rights change in people's attitudes.
Incredible. It happened in my lifetime.
Literally. I mean, when we were born, you know, being gay was illegal in some Australian states and presumably some American states, and within the span of between my being a kid and then my being old enough to want to get married to a guy, you went from total criminality to marriage. Like,
so you
that
can
was,
do it.
It was that fast. And
yeah,
and the
stunning victory
when that happened, who suddenly came out? It wasn't just young people who started coming out. All of a sudden, Uncle Herbie, who's 70, reveals that he was gay. All of every demographic and every age group, fairly equally, as the taboo lifted, came out and said, actually, I'm a married guy. I've been married for 50 years, but actually, I've always been hiding this lie. When the same thing happened to transgender norms, the vast majority of newly transgender people were kids, were young people. There was not a phenomenon the way there was with gayness of a huge number of 70-year-olds coming out and saying, actually, I'm a woman. I've been a woman all my life. There were some.
Yeah. Is that every night? Yeah, some.
But
some.
vanishingly few.
In the course of this conversation, which we periodically check back in, and for, some people are trans, you know, some people are
absolutely.
Trans.
Absolutely. I mean, of absolutely. Course. Yes. No,
yeah.
Totally.
When we're talking about the, when I talk about the social contagion aspect, I just try to check in every now and then and say, I'm not saying yeah, that's no, the only thing that was there. I'm just saying,
totally. Totally. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it may not even be a majority of the thing. It's just that anyone who even suggested that it was at all a thing was at risk of losing their job.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, for a time. Yeah. By the way, there's a great episode. I'm just trying to look up when it was. We did I had a chat with a guy called Nicholas Gruen, who is a professor. No, hang on. It wasn't Nicholas. I'm misremembering. It was Ronan McRae, who's a professor who has a new book about... this was released on January 9th on my podcast. So if you're, hello, this is Uncomfortable Conversations. If you're just joining from Jeff's side, I'm Josh Sepps. If you're just joining from my side, Jeff Mora is a satirist and former writer on Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, who now has a Substack. Very funny, very interesting.
Cross subscribe.
John doesn't have a Substack.
John
Jeff
doesn't,
has a
I
Substack.
Do.
I might be wrong. Which is political satire. And so there was an episode on January 9th, which you should go back and listen to, called The LGBTQ Threat to Gay Rights, with this professor who is basically saying that, like, all of those advances that we were just talking about from the gay rights movement, there's a lot of evidence that there's backsliding on that in terms of public opinion. And to regard those wins as, like, permanent and unassailable is incredibly naive. And one of the worst strategic moves that the gay movement has made over the past decade is hitching its wagon so enthusiastically to a much broader and more ideological project of gender identity, non-binariness, you know, transgenderism. You know, there's no such thing as male and female. Biological sex is a fiction, and like all of that stuff. Instead of allowing, he's like, nothing against any of that. That's great. It's its own movement. There's no LGBT, like, there's basically LG, maybe B, and T is a completely different thing, and we should support it. But to hold hostage all of the gains of gay rights to public acceptance of a seemingly infinitely expansive set of demands about how people ought to think about biology and gender is suicidal in a climate in which people are naturally becoming less prone to gay rights anyway, thanks in Europe partly to migration, thanks in America to the rise of Christian conservatism. So, like, I think that's interesting and just
thankfully
worth keeping in mind.
I think he's wrong that things are going to go so wrong for that movement, let's just call it that movement, because at the moment it's seen as one movement in the U.S. that, for example, we're going to go back to gay marriage being illegal. I don't think that would happen. I think the support for gay marriage is so robust. It is a court case that legalized gay marriage in the U.S. It wasn't an act of Congress. So that makes it a little more tenuous than it would otherwise
be. That
just
means that all you need is a Supreme Court decision, and then it's back to the states.
That's right.
They did it with Roe.
That's right. I don't see that happen. They did it with Roe. It's a.
I mean, we're talking about ever.
The quality
I mean,
of the decision in Roe versus Obergefell is very different, in my opinion.
Sure, but he's not saying that. Yeah. You know, he's not saying that. He's not predicting disaster in 5 years. He's saying for thousands of years, almost everywhere, this minority of people have been denigrated, and people all thought they were disgusting, and they've been persecuted. You know, LGBT people and. The idea that because 3 seconds ago we managed to get a bunch of successes and that therefore we can lord it over everybody with impunity and have no sense of the legitimacy of other people's concerns, of religious people's family, traditional ideas about family, for example. I mean, another point of his is that, like, the argument before gay marriage was we just want to be able to participate in marriage.
Yeah.
So now he says the number of gay married couples who are openly in open marriages, to some extent, from his perspective, it's a little bit of a slap in the face. Like, it's not exactly what we sold. It's not exactly what we sold the conservatives. Like, conservatives were willing to go along with it because we said that we wanted to be part of their club. And now that we're in their club, we're changing the club's rules. Those weren't the rules of the club created that we said we wanted to be part of.
I'm not saying
that it should be outlawed or anything. He's just saying, like, the whole movement has taken on an air of kind of sanctimonious self-entitlement, which maybe it might just want to check itself slightly.
Sanctimonious self-entitlement. Yes, I am a big believer in civil liberties and it goes back to John Stuart Mill, right? Do whatever you want as long as it's not hurting anybody. So as long as they're not forcing conservatives to be in open marriages, which I think is a very funny idea. But if they were doing that, I would say you can't make them go to the swingers party. That is, if they don't want to go, they don't have to go. But if you want to go, Godspeed.
This is fair enough. I take your point. I got a
story here that might interest you because, you're talking about overreach and how things change. I'm not only the guy who was one of the two leads on the 2015 John Oliver transgender piece. I'm also the guy who pitched it. I was the one who pitched, let's do a piece on this. So I can tell you exactly what I was thinking when I pitched that.
Great.
Obergefell had just happened. The case, Supreme Court case in the United States that made gay marriage legal. And suddenly this issue, gay marriage, that had, it had been a real hot button issue in the United States for a solid decade plus, really. I mean, how far back do you want to go? You could go back to, Andrew Sullivan's New Republic article in the mid-90s, but it had been a hot topic and suddenly total victory. Now what? And that's what I was thinking was now what? And I can tell you that my brain went to, okay, we have some level of acceptance of gay people. And the numbers get even better when you think about, young people's attitudes towards gay people. Young people overwhelmingly are, the stuttering in my voice comes from, it's not just that, like, it's gay marriage is legal. There's also just an accepting, there's an accepting. It's right, like, yes, you, that is, gay people in your lives.
There's a lot less, Jeff, especially in
If it's going backwards, that is bad news.
It's definitely gone backwards in the past 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah, that's bad news and has a lot to do with overreach. But I can tell you in 2015, I felt that the same kind of acceptance should be extended to trans people. And I still do feel that way. The line that I always push, because remember, I used to be a speechwriter, so I keep writing this on my blog, and I'm hoping somebody in the Democratic Party will pick this up, because I feel like this captures it. I think trans people should be equal in our laws and accepted in our hearts. I think that covers it.
Yeah.
That covers it. You don't need the nonsense about trans people in sports. Trans women in sports. You don't need to pretend that there is no difference between men's sports and women's sports. And you don't need to pretend that there is no advantage and that if there is any advantage, it can, be quickly removed with hormone suppressing drugs, which, by the way, we wouldn't want teenagers taking them for that reason anyway. So you don't need to buy into the nonsense on transgender sports. You don't need to buy into the nonsense about gender being a social construct. Stop it. Of course, it's not. It's like now I'm flashing back to when I was young and living in the South and people didn't believe in evolution. It's like, are we really going to be that anti-biology? Gender's a thing. We can talk about the people who don't neatly fit into gender categories, but gender's a thing.
I remember one thing that that Joe Rogan said early in this debate, which I think is still just the best line about it, which is like, if you go to a dog breeder to buy a female puppy and you get it home and you realize it's a male, you don't just go, oh, well, there's no difference. It's just a construct. Yeah. It's like, you take it back and you gave me a male dog. I wanted a female dog.
And I think it has to be that going that deep into the nonsense is what's causing some people to go, okay. And I haven't seen the numbers you've seen, but if there's backsliding on acceptance of gay rights and whatever, then surely that's the reason people are thinking, oh, so this whole movement is nuts, is it not? That's, in my opinion, that's a very bad territory that we've wandered into.
Mm. Yes. Well, go back and listen to the McRae episode of Uncomfortable Conversations, because he can articulate it a lot better than I can, and probably in a more impressive accent as well, because he's from the British Isles, our overlords. So just to wrap up the conversation about satire, so you got it, you go in there and can you just articulate this kind of daily, like, what is a pitch meeting like in 2015, and does it change when Trump comes into power, and what is that Trump era like, and trying to think about what exactly do we do with this man, and how do stories get elevated and stuff?
Well, there aren't pitch meetings at the John Oliver show. You always hear about these very tense pitch meetings at SNL. John Oliver's all done by email. So if you want to pitch something, you write up a very eloquent and hopefully funny email, and if they like it, then it'll get developed. Trump, at the beginning, you know, if we try to remember the mindset we were in 2015, he was this very bizarre figure, and nobody thought he would win. And there were a couple months where it was, you know, kind of funny. And it just seemed like it really did seem like it was good for comedy. Everyone always comes up to you when a comedian is like, Trump's great for comedy.
You mean before he was president, when he was just running?
When he was just running, right, yeah. Right. Nobody thought he would even win the Republican nomination. He was just this circus act that was in the mix. Mm. And so that's how we treated him. He was
my employer at the time. I don't know if you remember, but on Arianna Huffington's instructions, they moved Donald Trump's candidacy from the politics section to the entertainment section. And he was the only Republican candidate who was not covered in the politics section of the paper, the entertainment section, which just, when you look back on it, that was exactly what the kind of thing that middle America was in a backlash against.
There's also this famous clip of John Oliver when he was on The Daily Show, when he was hosting The Daily Show, when Jon Stewart had gone on hiatus. Trump, he hadn't announced yet, but he was speculating. He's like, I don't know, if things keep going the way they're going to go, and I'm thinking I might run. And then it comes back to John Oliver, and he says, do it. He looks in the camera and goes, do it. That was the attitude at the time. Yeah. It's like, it'll be funny. You can't possibly win. It'll be a big goof.
Yeah.
How wrong we were. There was a while where he was funny. We did the Drumpf piece, which was that was like gigantic for us. I mean, there's also, we're pretty good about not caring about this type of thing, I think, but anything Trump you did got like five times the rating of ratings of anything else you would do. So if you like look at the YouTube numbers for that Drumpf piece, it's just light years ahead of any other piece we did. Then it got old. And it got pretty unfunny. I am now, I've realized, I've been writing about this guy for a decade now. I've been writing about him for a decade. And I don't know what else to say about him. I try to write about him as little as I can. I mean, he's the elephant in the room, so you can't not write about him. But I do try to avoid just saying the same thing over and over and over. There's a lane in media where you can just make your name being the anti-Trump person. You know, a couple people pop to all of our minds when I say that. They just talk about Trump every day. It's here's the new outrage. I try to avoid that because, again, I'm trying to say something I haven't said before. So how many columns can I write that are just like, he's a dumb man. He's a dumb man doing dumb, bad things. So at the show, and I wrote a good amount of the Trump stuff that we did in the 2010s during his first term, we were at least trying to find something different to say about him each time. Mm-hmm. I wrote a piece again, I was one of the leads on a piece about, this is good. I don't want to claim credit for other people's work, but about authoritarianism that, at the time I wondered, did we overstate the case? And then in hindsight, I'm like, no, we understated the case. Mm-hmm. So that one aged okay, and I hope some of the others did too. Not that I'm going to go back and watch, that would be too painful, but
I mean, it was such a weird time. I remember one of the reasons why I moved back to Australia from New York, quite apart from the fact that I was having kids and wanted a calmer life, was not wanting to cover that man for years. Yeah. I mean, I came back in 2017 and I just felt like...
maybe I should move to Australia.
Move to Australia, man. Oh my God. Can I tell you how blissfully boring Australian politics is? It's like, it's great. It's like just,
great.
It's like such boring middle-aged white people, mostly male, just wandering around talking about like just boring, some mining.
That sounds lovely.
Tax. Just, you know, the prime minister will be off meeting the Japanese prime minister in Singapore at some stupid regional forum. There's like, it's, you know, everyone basically agrees on everything. It's like,
okay. That sounds great. I would love to get back to talking about the estate tax and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, the biggest issue at the last election was whether or not to build nuclear power. We already have a nuclear reactor for medical radioisotopes and stuff like that. But like, that was like the biggest, that was huge. Like the question of like, an arcane energy question of whether or not to complement the grid with nuclear. Anyway, so I like that. But that, I remember those early days of reporting on Trump and doing comedy and satire about Trump as being very, what's the word? Shallow, I would say. Like, revealing how genuinely uninterested the Acela corridor had been in the rest of the country, in anyone who disagreed with them, in people who weren't on the same, who weren't drinking the same Kool-Aid of social justice liberalism. It was like, Trump is stupid, he's orange and he's a clown, he's a buffoon, he's silly, he's racist. And like, there wasn't much of an attempt, and I feel a little bit paralyzed now, because now it's gotten so bad, and he is so obviously a genuine threat to the Republic, in a way I don't think he's ever been until now.
Second term is so much worse than the first term.
So much worse. And I would even say 2026, so much worse than 2025.
It's on a steady downward trajectory.
Like, we keep thinking
we're
going to
slam it to the bottom, and
this?
We never do.
Like, are you kidding me? We've got three more. What? I mean, like, Jesus, like, you're seizing election ballots in Georgia to try to hunt down election officials to prosecute them for properly certifying the 2020 election, arresting journalists like Don Lemon on trumped up charges, trying to find, you know, random things that who was that justice, the woman who he is accused, they found her guilty apparently of defraud, writing something wrong on her home mortgage loan.
Oh yeah, that's right, Lisa Cook, which apparently she didn't even do, by the way.
But even if she had, how many Republicans in Congress have done that thing? You know, you don't, as a leader, just target people you don't like and then go hunting around
trying to find arcane
little reasons why you can ruin their lives and drag them through the courts for the next 3 years and bankrupt them.
It's Banana Republic stuff. It's Banana Republic
totally
stuff.
Totally inconsistent with being a Western democracy. It's like, we haven't seen this in what I would have traditionally called a civilized country. We haven't seen this in, like, the club of Western democracies, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, the United States, and Western Europe.
Viktor Orban in Hungary is the only other example.
That's it.
That's it. And we have a few more people than Hungary does in this country. Yeah.
So,
and a lot more nuclear weapons.
I mean, I guess we can wrap this up, but just by, I mean, give me some fucking insight, Jeff. Like, I we were so bad the first time around in Trump won at I guess, humanizing the people who liked him. Like, I think the only way we get out of this without a civil war, honestly, is if we continue to ramp up our hatred and demonization of MAGA and all its supporters, then the left will get into power and will not be able to resist the temptation of doing something similar, maybe not as bad, but it will not be pure. And both sides will ratchet themselves into an ever-intensifying war of attrition, which is quite hard to then stop the centrifuge and get back to normality. Yeah. So I feel like you almost need a truth and reconciliation process of some kind, which humanizes which cleaves off. It's like a counterterrorism strategy, actually, or like after apartheid in South Africa. After apartheid, Nelson Mandela didn't go hunting for the criminals, the racist criminals who had run South Africa, he invited them into his cabinet and was like, the only way we're going to get out of this without killing each other is like if we all work together on what we can agree on. And a counterterrorism strategy is similar, like cleave off the extremists and try to isolate them and then win over the largest quorum of the other side as you can. In fact, I remember a line from an Israeli general who said, everyone keeps talking about us and the Palestinians, us and them, us and them. He's like, it's not us and them. It's some of us and some of them against some of them and some of us. And like framing it that way and trying to think about how do you outfox Trumpism by winning over some segment of his winnable fans is like the big conundrum.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said that I don't like to write about Trump these days because I feel like it's just the same thing over and over. And that's true. So I often ask myself, okay, then what do I write about? You know, how can I talk about what's going on in the world, but not just write another? And now he's doing this outrageous thing column. I write about strategy a lot, democratic strategy. Again, I used to be a speechwriter, albeit for an agency, but before I was at EPA, I had a couple low-level jobs at democratic politics. I think about strategy a lot and you know, what is a smart thing to do, what's not a smart thing to do. One thing I can say about the right half of the American political spectrum, and I very much take your point about, like, I don't like demonizing people. I've never been somebody who's like, cut off your uncle who likes Trump. You know, don't do that. Don't cut off your uncle. People are complex and people have all sorts of political views. And, you know, speaking for myself, that's not how I want to live. So I wouldn't recommend anybody do that. I am kind of flummoxed that, you know, very bad things are happening. He's not following the law, not remotely. There's sort of a Watergate sized scandal every week or two. And not everyone, but enough people are like, it's great that it's happening. What do you do in response to that? How do you process that? I will say most people who vote Republican just hate Democrats. That's it. There's some ideology, but that is the glue keeping a coalition that is sometimes 51% of the country together. They just hate Democrats. That's it. If you watch Fox News, and you know, for many years for my job I had to, and I still check in, they're just vilifying Democrats all the time. Every narrative that they like about immigration or, you know, racially tinged things or, you know, woke overreach or whatever, it always ties back to Democrats because Democrats in this story are the enablers of everything bad in this country. They just hate Democrats. And that's why one thing I talk about over and over and over and write about over and over and over is how Democrats need to make, sorry to use this term, but their brand. I don't work for them, so I don't know if they're a they or a we, but the Democratic brand needs to be better. When people think of the left, when they think of Democrats, they are thinking of Billie Eilish saying, no one is illegal on stolen land. Why don't Democrats more frequently stand up and just say, like, well, that was a dumb thing to say. That's all you have to say. That was a dumb thing to say. I don't agree with that. They're so afraid of alienating the progressive wing of the coalition. They don't realize they've got the math completely wrong. There are like 10 freaks on Blue Sky who will be offended if you say, well, that was a dumb thing to say. But there is a very large swath of people in the center who could be won over as long as they know that you're not some kind of lefty freak who thinks that this is all stolen land. Or at least I guess it is stolen land, but there's something we could do about that. It's like all the land's stolen. Yes,
there is no such thing as unstolen land. It's stolen
land. There's not. I wish we hadn't. I wish it hadn't happened. Yeah. But we can't rewind the clock, and it's all stolen. Yeah. So where are you going to go?
I think that strategically, they think that it's more. Well, they might just be cowards. But to be generous to them, strategically, they probably think that it's more important not to alienate the base and have people stay home than it is to,
I guess,
try to win over. That it's harder to win over a new person than it is to energize the base. But I think that's flawed because that logic just only ends you into your own. It ends in your own navel. Like, you're just so far up your own ass that you become unappealing to everyone but the true believers.
Well, there's also just mountains of statistical evidence at this point suggesting that there are votes to be won at the center. You can tack to this center, and that's where the votes are. They're not on the wings. Because of social media, I think a lot of times we think they're at the wings, but they're not.
Mm. Of course. And it's so obvious. I mean, just think about the kinds of conversations. If I were to parachute you into, you know, any home in the Midwest right now, in swing states, right, in like battleground, in purple states.
Yeah, Michigan.
Yeah, my partner's from New England, Michigan, from New Hampshire, Wisconsin. Okay? So that's another purple state. Went for Hillary, went for Trump. So the conversations that you hear in diners, these are all basically center-left and center-right people.
Yeah.
There are not a lot of people talking about extremes. Most people are on this roughly the same, but they're in the same general kind of Overton window of what they want. And they haven't been served that by the Democratic Party since Obama.
Yeah. And they want to trust you, which makes perfect sense because, you know, unfortunately, you and I have this sickness where we follow politics very closely, but most people don't. Ought to be in their shoes. They don't follow politics that closely. They don't want to go through this stuff with a fine-tooth comb. They want to trust the person they elect to get it right. And in order for that to happen, they need to believe that the person is trustworthy. They need to believe they're not some kind of freak, not some kind of, you know, extremist wacko. So I don't understand why Democrats, because most Democrats, elected officials, like most of them are not extremist wackos. You know, there are plenty of other failings, you know, cowardice being the most common. But the ones I've encountered, very rarely are they truly an extremist wacko. But so many people on the left have lost their voice to have what we in the States sometimes call a sister soldier moment, which was when Bill Clinton, you know, this is ancient history, but there was a rapper named Sister Soldier and she had this really extreme song. And Bill Clinton said that she has some unbelievable extreme comment about America's the most racist, whatever. I forget exactly what it was. It was just insane. And all Bill Clinton said was, well, that's insane. That's not true. And it helped people understand that, okay, so Bill Clinton is not an extremist wacko. Again, talk about people with failings, but not that particular failing. And Democrats so often can't find our voice to respond to things and say, like, well, that's nutter. You know, if we're talking about immigration, it's like, yeah, we want sane and rational and humane enforcement of immigration laws, but there does need to be enforcement of immigration laws. Why is that so hard to say? Sometimes they do say it, but sometimes they fail.
Jeff, thank you for explaining to me finally what the actual genesis of the sister soldier moment is, because I understand the meaning of the term from context cues in American politics, like standing up to your own side, because that's the way everybody uses it. But I did not know that sister soldier was a person who said a thing that Bill Clinton refuted. So I'm wiser today, as we all.
Well, there you go. Yeah, and I learned about camels. So you know,
it's win-win all around. On the podcast. If you're coming over from Uncomfortable Conversations, subscribe to Jeff Mora's Substack, even just to the free tier. I might be wrong. It's called Comedy Politics and Swearing in pretty much equal amounts. Jeff is very funny and insightful, as you can tell. If you're coming over from Jeff's side, subscribe to Uncomfortable Conversations, where we have lots of interesting and hopefully fearless and bullshit-free conversations about the most important issues that we face as a civilization, and some laughs.
I enjoyed it, Josh. Can I give the address? It's imightbewrong.org. And if you're not sure whether you like my stuff or not, half of it's free. Half of it's in front of the paywall, so you can find out for yourself.
At least half is free, not paywalled, if you go to uncomfortableconversations.substack.com or find Uncomfortable Conversations, the podcast, on your favorite podcast player. How's that? That was pretty good, wasn't it?
That was fantastic. Very professional.
Yeah, I thought so. Thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Josh.